Seated. Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome students from the Mid-State Technical College. Would the students please stand so we can meet them? Good seeing you all. You may be seated. I believe that you will have to leave at 2, which will be midway through the argument, so I wanted to advise counsel so they're not distressed as everybody leaves. You will not have said anything to offend these students. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley and Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, I now call the third case, 05AP423, Carl McNeil versus Brandon Hansen. Arguing on behalf of Carl McNeil is John A. Becker. Mr. Becker.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is John Becker, and I represent the plaintiff, Carl McNeil. The facts in this case are very simple. The plaintiff was in the process of servicing a vehicle in a quick-change oil place. He was in front of the car when the defendant, to check the oil level, reached into the car to start the car, turned the key, the vehicle lurched forward, and injured the plaintiff. Now, the facts are very simple and straightforward. Wisconsin has a statute, the workers' comp statute, provide that you cannot sue a co-employee except for the negligent operation of a motor vehicle. So what we have here are three issues, as I see it. One, the trial court ruled that the term operate did not include starting the car. So the first question we have is the term operate ambiguous in this context? Second issue is, if the court determines it's ambiguous, how do we construe it? Do we construe it broadly or narrowly or somewhere in between? And the third question would be, even if we construe it narrowly, does it still include the operation of a motor? Does that include starting the car? Now, some of the arguments that I present may overlap a little bit in addressing those three issues, but there's a number of things that we have to look at. First, we have to look at the common and ordinary use of the term operate. Dictionary definition. Secondly, we need to look at other definitions that the statute or that the legislature has used in the past. And we have to look at the intent of the statute, try to figure out what the intent of the legislature was. And we have to look at all of that in the context of the facts of this case. So the first question is the statute ambiguous? And again, the trial court never said what it meant. The trial court's decision, the oral decision, said it's clearly an accident that occurred at the workplace. Both employees were engaged in a work-related activity. Given those facts in this case, the court's going to grant the defendant's motion. So there never was a definition given of what operation meant. And again, as I said, in the Welland case, a term can be ambiguous under one set of facts, but not ambiguous under another set of facts. So looking at it with these facts, the first question is it ambiguous? Now, again, in addressing whether the term operation is defined by the legislature is ambiguous, the court in Berg said that the statute is not ambiguous. Now, operate is not a technical term. So what's the first thing we do is we look at the common and ordinary use of the term operate. And under the dictionary definition, it means to cause to function. You start a car, you turn the key, you're causing it to function. Second thing. If you look at it in the context of the statute and the facts, there's three different terms that the legislature uses when dealing with operating or using a motor vehicle. They use drive, they use operate, and they use. Drive is defined in several places as controlling the speed and or direction, or the speed or direction of the vehicle. Operate has to encompass more than that. So if the vehicle is not moving or turning, operate still must encompass more than just moving when the vehicle is not moving.
Let me just ask you, and I think this is a very interesting case and one that could have, I think, a big effect. Say we're in Wisconsin, we have workman's comp, and a lot of the businesses have motor vehicles. In fact, when I take my car down to the mechanic and he wants to check the timing or he wants to fix the fan or make sure that they always have to start the vehicle to see, you know, to put it on the machine. He says in the old days they didn't need this, but now they have a machine. It tells you everything. My question is, and this happened in the workplace, what, if any, effect do you think if we were to accept the, quote, the definition or the broad definition, what effect would this have on other industries, not perhaps the oil change could, but just where you take your car to the mechanic and it's in the garage and they have to start it. Does this mean that every mechanic should have separate insurance other than workman's comp?
What it means is if you are in that business and you're operating a car that's not owned or leased by the employer, and again, I was going to get to that a little bit later, but I mean, the intent of the statute clearly seems to be that they expect a person who's going to operate a car to have insurance. So
even the people that are on the assembly line that are making the car when they have to start it?
Well, I don't know that they're operating a motor vehicle at that point.
Well, they're starting the motor. I'm just asking these. I don't know. If I knew the answer, I'm asking you what you think, because once we say that reaching in and starting it, then we have, you know, we're not, I'm just not talking about this case. I'm just thinking about the general effect.
Well, I don't think it's going to be honest, I think the facts are fairly limited, and I don't think it would have much effect at all, to be honest.
Well, doesn't it affect the insurance industry? Who's covered? Which insurance policy is going to cover this?
Well, in this case, there's a number of different policies that could apply. The owner of the vehicle.
There's no exception for bringing it in for repairs in the auto.
No,
okay.
No. When I go to an oil change place, they make me drive in. They don't let me get out of the car because they don't want their employees driving my car. You know, so maybe they'll be more cautious and do it that way. I mean, it may eliminate accidents is what it may do. By making the, you know, not allowing the employees to be driving other people's car unless it's absolutely necessary.
But if the guy doesn't have any insurance, we don't require insurance in Wisconsin. So what if the owner doesn't have insurance on the car, then what covers?
Well, I guess it's like an uninsured motorist case. I mean, when you're on the road, you hope other people are going to have insurance. Certainly the legislature encourages people to have insurance. If you get in an accident and you don't have insurance, you can lose your license. Does that guarantee that every accident and every action somebody's going to have insurance? No. But it's the expectation is that if you're going to operate a motor vehicle, you should have insurance.
Right, but if you don't have insurance and you're on the highway, if you're not negligent, you don't have to pay. And if the owner gives his car to the guy to change the oil, and he doesn't have insurance, but he's financially responsible, how's he negligent? How are you ever going to get money out of him?
The owner of the vehicle is not liable here. The owner of the vehicle was not negligent. His insurance may cover a permissive user, so if he allows the mechanic to drive the car.
Right, I understand that, but what if he doesn't have insurance?
Wait a minute. You just said drive.
I'm sorry.
Well, we're only talking about operating, not driving.
Correct.
And that's what I was kind of limiting to that.
I'm sorry, and that was my mistake. Again, are there going to be circumstances? Could it arise when an employee does not have insurance? Yes, it could. There's no question it could. But the statute doesn't say the exception is for the negligent operation of a motor vehicle of an employee who has insurance. That's not written into the statute.
That's not what it says. I agree with you.
Is Maryland Casualty Company the insurer for the employee here in terms of his auto insurance or in terms of his homeowner's insurance?
I believe Maryland Casualty actually is an insurance policy provided through the employer. In this case, if you look at the intent of the, and Mr. Stewart may be able to clarify that, but if you look at the intent of the statute, it was, at least back in the 70s, employees were generally excluded from fleet insurance policies. Maybe that's changed, but my understanding is that Maryland Casualty, in this case, actually insures the employer, and they do provide coverage to the co-employee in this case.
Thank you.
So, again, when we look at the terms that they use, they did not use the term drive, they used the term operate. So, again, operate would encompass more than driving. And as the court said in Modri, if the legislature wanted to limit the statute to drive, they could have said so. They used the term operate. And it was actually the defendant who brought up in his brief the concept of peri materia. I think I pronounced that right. Which says language is not to be considered in isolation, but in the context of closely related statutes. All of the other statutes that we have that define operate in terms of a motor vehicle define it the exact same way. The manipulation or activation of the controls of any control necessary to put the vehicle in motion. So, clearly, starting a car comes within that definition. I think the Court of Appeals in their petition to the Supreme Court said that it clearly comes within that definition. So if we look at it in the context of its ordinary dictionary definition, if we look at it in terms of the definitions given to operate by the legislature, and we look at the fact that they use the term operate instead of drive, it encompasses these facts. So when you look at these facts, it is our position that it's not ambiguous. It clearly encompasses starting the car.
You have to start the car to put it in motion, but it doesn't go into motion unless something else is done, except here, because it had a, quote, manual shift. I haven't had one for a while, but it went in right away. That was the... Does it make any difference if your client told Mr. Hansen to do that? This is in a workplace.
That's an element of contributory negligence.
That's right. So that wouldn't make any difference.
I don't really see that.
The whole question is just about operate.
Correct.
So why did the vehicle lurch forward?
When did it?
Why?
It was left in gear. It was a standard transmission. The key was turned. He didn't get in the car to put the clutch in, and it lurched forward and pushed Mr. McNeil through the garage door.
Was it up on the, was on a hoist or just on the ground floor?
Just on the ground.
Yeah. Because he was flushing the radiator. Then it had a bunch of, I'm not familiar with that procedure. Probably never had it done. Should have, but.
It's not too late.
Not too late, but, well, it's.
Careful.
As I understand it, and just looking at the fact, it was hooked up to a bunch of tubes. You must have something where you put it, where you put the antifreeze in, and then something where it comes out on the bottom. That's what I'm assuming.
I believe it was oil, because I don't think they used cans of oil. I think, you know, those oil change places have like big drums of it, and they just put a hose in.
But you wouldn't put oil. What are you talking about? Oil in a radiator? No, you're flushing the radiator. It has nothing to do with oil. I thought
they were changing the oil.
oh, I didn't. I thought they were flushing the radiator. Anyway, that was my.
Maybe they're doing both, to be
honest. Maybe it doesn't make any, and I'm sure it doesn't make any difference.
Well, we get a one rule for the radiator.
One for the oil.
Let's do that.
Well, then it might become important.
Right. Sure. We'll take that under advice.
I thought it was flushing the radiator.
To be honest, I'm not 100% sure, but I don't know if it matters.
Well, one, you're underneath the car, and the other, you're in front of it.
He's in front of it.
Yeah.
He's in front of the car.
Yeah, okay.
There's no question he was in front of the car.
I did.
He was thinking about the oil.
It's our position that when you look at the words that were used, you look at the normal definition, you look at the legislative definitions in other sections of the statutes, it's not ambiguous. That starting the car comes within operate. Huh. Now, if the court determines that the term is ambiguous, the next question
becomes... Mr. Becker, let me interrupt you for a minute. The exception under 102.032 is not just for operation of a motor vehicle, it's for negligent operation. What are the allegations of negligence here?
That he got in the car and started it without putting the clutch in when there's a person in front of the vehicle. Again, that would be a question of fact. Maybe if they can convince a jury that that's not negligence, they can win, but that really wasn't the issue on summary judgment.
I don't want to be picking on this, but he didn't get in the car. He just reached through the window and turned the key, didn't he?
Exactly. That's part of the problem.
Is part of the allegation that your client asked him to start the car?
That's part of their defense.
Is there a dispute on that?
There is some.
Well, yeah.
You know, there are some issues. I mean, he claims that he wasn't trained to get in and put the clutch in and make sure that, you know, it's in neutral before he starts it. There's other testimony to say that that's what he was taught. I mean, those are factual issues that haven't been resolved. But there is no question. He reached in, turned the key, and started the car.
In contemplating this case, how extraordinary or rare was this event?
I believe it was very rare. I mean, we looked for other cases. Actually, the facts that I read you were actually taken from the North case out of Michigan. But that was really, I mean, that was the only case I could find. Then there was the one from Connecticut, which, again, different facts. But I don't think this is not a common occurrence. I'm sorry.
Excuse me. This brings me back to my question of just where you have a mechanic in a garage. To test cars, you have to have it started. Now, if there's another co-employee, they have to, if they start the car and then there's an injury, if we were to accept your proposition, it would be, we'd be saying, well, there's a possibility that a person who starts the car, doesn't go anywhere, just starts it, could be held liable outside of workman's compensation.
Correct. If it's a car that's not owned or leased by the employer, yes.
And that is almost typical of every garage in the state of Wisconsin. I mean, just trying to...
I don't doubt that. I mean, you know, I don't care if you work for an auto, you know, you sell cars, you know, they move cars around. Could they hit, of course, a lot of the cars that they move around are owned by the employer, so there's not...
I'm not moving any cars. I'm just just turning the key.
It moved. Car moved.
Would they be liable? Yes. I mean, that's what the statute says. I guess... We'll get to the second issue, is if it's ambiguous.
Well, let me just...
I'm sorry.
Words have meanings. If you look in the dictionary, it could have 3, 4, 5 meanings, and they might not even be close to each other in the language. Just because words have different meanings doesn't mean the words are ambiguous. And I know you're going to go through... the Kalal exercise, and that's fine. So when you get off ambiguous, you're going to see what you can look at. This is a workers' comp case. The general rule is, as I understand workers' comp, general rule is if you're injured while you're on the job, and I'm overstating this, if you're injured while on the job, your exclusive remedy is workers' comp. I mean, that's... generally the rule. This
yes.
guy is injured. He is on the job in his scope of employment, and he is injured. So if it weren't for a motor vehicle here, there'd probably be no case. He might have a products liability case, but not against a co-employee. There's an exception in this statute for operation of automobiles, right?
Yes.
Now, to keep with the public policy of workers' comp, should that exception be narrowly construed or broadly construed? Do we want to give employees more causes of action against co-employees or fewer? And why is there this exception in workers' comp?
All right.
Suppose it was a boat. Wouldn't have an exception for the boat, would you?
I'm sorry, for what?
You wouldn't have an exception if it were a boat or an airplane.
Motor vehicle.
That might be a motor vehicle.
It's a motor vehicle, right, okay.
Could be another issue for another day. I'll address your questions. First of all, the workers' comp statutes, keep in mind, are a safety net for the employee.
Mm-hmm.
It's been the
they're the only net. They're exclusive net.
I'm sorry?
They're the exclusive net.
Well, except
That's
for this exception.
Except for the exception.
Okay. Now, the court has said a number of times the fundamental purpose of the Workers' Compensation Act is to compensate the injured employee.
All right.
Now, if we look at what an employee gets under workers' comp, they get their medical bills paid. They get two-thirds of their wages. Now, a person who makes $10 an hour, that's about $20,000 a year. The theory behind that is that it's non-taxable, it's supposed to balance out. But a person making $20,000 a year does not pay $6,700 in taxes. They come out on the short end of that. They don't get, they can have their health insurance cut off, they can have benefits cut off, they get nothing for pain and suffering. That's what you get under workers' comp. So it is a safety net. Yeah, there are trade-offs, and that's, you know, they gave up certain rights, and you limit your recovery because you don't have to prove negligence. But there is an exception. And if you look at the exception, you might say, well, why did they include this exception? I think if you look at the exception to the exception, that gives us a pretty good idea why they have the first exception. Because the exception to the exception says, except for, you cannot sue a co-employee for the negligent operation of a motor vehicle owned or leased by the employer. And the intent for that is in the legislative history. It says because the employee probably, under most fleet insurance policies, they would not be covered. In fact, in the Oliver case, the statute was challenged as being unconstitutional, that there was no rational basis to distinguish between owned and non-owned vehicles. And the court said there is a rational basis. They said because most drivers slash owners will have automobile liability insurance company. So clearly that gives us the reason why the legislature left this exception in, because an employee who's not operating an employer-owned vehicle is expected to have insurance. There should be insurance coverage, so we're not going to take that right away from the injured employee. Yes, there are trade-offs, and they get workers' comp, but we're not going to take that right. When there's probably going to be insurance coverage, we're not going to take that right away from them. So that's why it should be construed broadly.
Counselor, I thought that one of the reasons was that workers' comp was to provide remedies for injuries that are typical of the workplace and injuries received because of an automobile accident when you're not driving the employer's vehicle were things that the general public was subject to, so workers' comp wasn't supposed to cover.
Well, I don't think there is such a thing as a typical injury in workers' comp. There are...
Typical of the workplace. You know, if you work with presses that make molded plastic goods or whatever, we see lots of injuries for people's hands and that kind of stuff that you wouldn't, the general public is not subjected to, but the worker is because that's the industry the worker's in.
Well, that was the issue that was raised in the Connecticut courts. And the case that came down after all the briefs were filed, the Connecticut court said, I mean, there was some language to that effect in the Dias case in Connecticut, and the Supreme Court of Connecticut said, look, that would just be unmanageable to start trying to have this special hazards test. That's not in the statute. The statute says there's an exception for operating a motor vehicle. There's no special hazards test involved.
Counsel, let's say a backhoe is a motor vehicle, and facts of this case are the same, the co-employees, one telling the other to move the backhoe, and I don't know how a backhoe operates, but let's say if you just turn it on and it's in gear, it lurches forward. The backhoe is owned by a different employer. It's on a work site.
Well, in Diaz,
how does that work out?
In Diaz, a backhoe, and I've never operated one, but they said when the backhoe was on and when it could be moved as a vehicle, the shovel part would not work. When the shovel part was being operated, the other became inoperable. So that's why that was the distinction, and that's why the language came up in the Diaz case. But this most recent case, the Colangelo case, they clarified that language, saying that's we didn't mean to create a special hazard
so
test.
If this were a backhoe, you know, kind of a real typical, if we're going to use that term, employment site, then the plaintiff can still bring the cause of action.
If it was a vehicle not owned or leased by the employer. Now, let me get real quickly to my arguments on, even if you construe it narrowly, why it would still come within this. One, if the definition given by the legislature is narrow, you could construe this much more broadly. We know it encompasses more than drive. The legislature has given us a clear-cut definition. WMC in the brief says, we want a mechanical approach. It should be decided on a case-by-case basis. There's nothing, the statute, we don't want a statute that's so imprecise and unclear that we have to decide on a case-by-case basis, the legislature gives us a very clear, narrow reading. For example, if you're working on a windshield and somebody turns the windshield wipers on, cuts your finger off, is that an operation of a motor vehicle? I think it could be. When you look at the intent, it probably would be covered under insurance. It's probably something you'd want to say, well, that co-employee would be covered by insurance, so we want them to recover. But it doesn't come under the definition given to us by the legislature. So that is a narrow definition.
It could be construed
much more broadly.
We have limited time. On page 14 of your opponent's brief, he says the legislature intended to protect co-employees from lawsuits involving work-related accidents with very narrow exception to the application of the exclusivity provision. That's the quotes Hock, the Hake case. I'm not sure. But what I'm saying, isn't that one of the ideas where when you go to work, you don't have separate insurance? You're protected. You, the co-employee, is protected by the workman's comp as far as their insurance. Isn't that one of the reasons for it?
I'm sorry. Maybe I didn't understand the question.
Well, the question is, we were talking about workers' comp. I thought one of the reasons for it, it's very narrow, or it should be broad. I'm just saying if you thought narrow, a co-employee, should they be covered by some other insurance or by the workman's comp in the normal situation?
Well, the co-employee,
which is Mr. Hansen.
I mean, it's my understanding, when looking at the legislation,
right.
It's expected that if you're operating some other vehicle, you're going to have insurance. I mean, he certainly would be covered by workers' comp. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Yes, I understand that. But this, and it's pointed out, I think, in the amicus brief, too, that this is going to be special to one industry. That's where you're operating a motor vehicle under a narrow definition.
There's no question. It will occur more often in an industry where there are motor vehicles involved. I mean, there's
or a backhoe or whatever. Okay.
That's certainly, potentially, yes. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Ed Stewart, and I'm representing Brandon Hansen, the defendant from the personal injury lawsuit that was brought. A couple of quick clarification points regarding some of the discussion from Attorney Becker. One being that Maryland Casualty is a party in this action merely because it paid 102 under Chapter 10229 because it paid workers' compensation benefits because this is a workers' compensation case. It is not a party for this case because it provided coverage to Brandon Hansen. And as far as I know, Brandon Hansen has no insurance to speak of. Secondly, there's no question based upon the facts in my brief, which refers to the deposition transcripts and whatnot. Undisputed material facts are that, indeed, there was a radiator flush being performed, and the subject wrangler was, indeed, connected to the radiator flush machine when the incident at issue occurred. Another thing, just to clear up some things that I heard, is that you are accurate that Brandon Hansen did not get inside the vehicle. Brandon Hansen was standing outside of the vehicle when the incident at issue occurred. And it's an undisputed material fact that he had no intention of driving the vehicle, steering the vehicle, getting into the vehicle, braking the vehicle, or accelerating the vehicle. One other point that I wanted to notice is that I recently had an oil change, and indeed I was told to get out of my car, and they pulled it into the service bay. So that's just some clarification points from what I heard.
Mr. Stewart, let me ask you, because you've been talking about undisputed material facts.
Yes.
My understanding of the statute is that it creates an exception to workers' comp for negligent operation of a motor vehicle. As I listened to the attorney on the other side, I got the feeling that there's some issues of negligence.
Oh.
Isn't that part of material facts?
Yes, but however, Your Honor, we're talking about the interpretation of a statute. And when we're interpreting statutes, these are things that need to be determined as a matter of law. And so it's not a factual determination for a jury. The narrow issue before this court is whether or not the conduct of Brandon Hansen under these circumstances constituted the negligent operation of a motor vehicle. Now, how I was going to start out.
Well, this was a summary judgment action, right?
That is correct.
So did the judge, Judge Donald, make a determination that under these facts there was a negligent operation of a motor vehicle? I read what he said, and he didn't say a whole heck of a lot.
What he determined, Your Honor, was this, is that the undisputed material facts at issue in this case, and he interpreted the statute, which is a determination by the court as a matter of law, and there's numerous cases that discuss interpretation of statute, is not something for the trier of fact, but instead is something for the court and for you here today. And under this factual circumstance, Your Honor, he determined that his conduct did not constitute operation of a motor vehicle.
Well, did he say more than what the excerpt that we have in the briefs? In other words, what I read, I didn't see him making any determinations in regard to whether there were any genuine issues of material fact, whether a prima facie case had been established for the granting of summary judgment. I saw none of that in what I was reading. Did I miss something?
What you learned is that he understood what the undisputed material facts were, and in applying those undisputed material facts, he was of the opinion, and it's the correct opinion, Your Honor, that that did not constitute the operation of a motor vehicle under the narrow exception, and it has to be narrowly construed, of the exclusive remedy provision of the Workers' Compensation Act.
Counselor, I think maybe what Justice Crooks is trying to get at with you, that the term negligent informs how we interpret operation, not just whether there's a question of fact, but whether this could be a negligent operation, or because that term is used, it requires a more narrow construction of the statutes. That what would have been envisioned was someone actually intent upon operating the motor vehicle for the sake of operating the motor vehicle, not for the sake of flushing, helping with the radiator flush. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, to a certain point, because the word negligence is causing you to pause prior to the term that this court needs to determine, and that is whether or not his conduct constituted operation of a motor vehicle under this limited exception to the compact.
Let me ask the question this way. Was this really a motion to dismiss failure to state a claim of action rather than a summary judgment? And so you accept there was negligence in turning the key. You accept that there was a co-employee. You accept that it was flushing the radiator, I think. You accept all that, and then you say, accepting all those facts to be true, you don't state a claim of action because under the statute, turning the key is not operation. Is that what the trial court decided?
Yes, Your Honor. Except I never conceded any negligence on behalf of my client.
I understand that. You
right. But yes, Your Honor, you're absolutely correct.
One of the concerns for me in this case is the moving workplace. By that I mean, you know, back in the good old days, a workplace was a workplace. It had had backhoes, or it had places that you would get your oil changed. But now, workplaces are, you know, can be in your home. For the salesperson, it's on the road all the time. That's their workplace. Let me give you a fact situation that seems a little different, but legally raises the same question. Two co-employees going to an appointment together. Let's say they're insurance sales. They're clearly within the course of conduct. Clearly, workers' comp would cover them for purposes of being in the course of business, you know, employment. And the co-employee drives the car. They're out on the highway. They think they have a flat tire. The plaintiff, guest passenger, gets out in front of the car, is starting to decide whether or not, you know, we should have to change the tire. He's in front of the car. Car is off. for some reason, this is on the highway, the co-employee drives off, reaches in, turns the key, activates the car hits the plaintiff. How do you analyze that?
Well, that's an interesting factual scenario that we don't have here, but how you analyze that is...
The legal question is the same, whether or not...
It's a bit different, though, and I'll tell you. I'll tell you. The incident at issue here, Your Honor, was a work accident that occurred on work premises among coworkers who were involved in the integral process of performing the functions of their job.
You've got plenty of cases that say if you're a traveling salesman, you're in the course of your employment. You know? That's why I prefaced my comment. You don't need to be a warehouse or a foundry or in order to be in the course of your employment and be, you know, working.
Right. Well, that goes to, I think one of counsel's arguments is just simply wrong, and that goes to the fact that is the term under the limited exception to the workers' comp statute, is it ambiguous? And, of course, we are here, Your Honor. You're asking a great question.
Well, I don't know if I am.
The term operation of a motor vehicle under the guise of this statute is indeed ambiguous.
Okay. But in my fact situation, because legally I believe, I intend to ask the same question, is that co-employee who owns the car and is reaching in, turning it on, which causes it to be thrust forward and hit the plaintiff who's in front of the car going to change the flat
scenario.
Tire. Yeah. That, I think legally that's the same question. In other words, is he operating the motor vehicle?
Right. My case is better. And the reason it's better is because I have better facts with respect to the inherent part of their job. However, I would argue that given the fact this is an exception, because it's ambiguous.
In my case, is he operating the motor vehicle?
I would say no. Because you have to have a narrow construction of the term operation. And I think it's interesting that the legislature didn't define operation in the statute. They did not incorporate any of the statutes he alludes to, including the drunk driving statute, including the operating without permission statute. Okay? They were silent because they did not want a rigid, inflexible, mechanical application to the very limited exception that must be narrowly construed here.
Well, counsel, let's take a fact situation that is, as you say, closer to yours, but that changes the facts a little bit, because I'm also, like Justice Bradley, I'm concerned about the scope of this decision. Let's say we have exactly the facts that you have, but add the added twist that you just mentioned when you began your argument, that what happens instead of reaching in to turn on the vehicle, the other coworker gets into the vehicle, pull it forward, and in the process of pulling it forward, the vehicle lurches and hits Hanson. Is that operation?
These are very good questions, and that's one reason that I referred to the Connecticut test, that they one factor to consider. I'm not the only bright line I'm advocating here. Rule that I want adopted is that my client's conduct under the facts of these case simply did not. But I understand there's a bigger picture.
This is at work, in a worker's setting, at the place of employment, where the worker is doing something in performance of their duties to flush the radiator. If they're going to pull it in to the radiator flush area before they operate. So everything is the same except he's going to pull it in as opposed to it already being there.
I'm with you. And I believe, again, my factual scenario is better. But taking yours into account, that's one reason the Connecticut case I cite at the end of my brief, they adopt a test that I'm not saying you have to adopt, but I think it's a case-by-case analysis, and it's a good exercise to perform when you're interpreting this ambiguous statute.
I don't think it's a case-by-case analysis. I think it's the question is whether or not, I don't care where you are and what you're doing, maybe. When this case says turning the key, is that, and so it's, the ignition goes on, is that operating? Isn't that the question we're grappling with?
under the facts of this case, but with Justice Butler, to finish him, and I'll come to you if I can keep it together, that exercise from the Connecticut case, they adopted a test whether or not it's a common danger, and I believe Justice Rogensack was touching on that earlier, or a common danger to the public as opposed to a special hazard of the workplace. And one thing I wanted to do right when I started out, in addition to
what's the answer to the question?
The answer to the question, as far as I'm concerned, is that given the fact you must apply a narrow construction because we have an ambiguous term, and therefore you need to take into account the number one canon of construction is the context, scope, history, intent, and purpose of the statute.
So is it operation?
No. And I say it's no because we're talking about two workers inside the service bay, as I understand your question.
That's correct.
Confined to the premises of their employment, performing the essential functions of their job. And guys like Brandon Hansen or anybody in the automotive industry, I don't think they should go to work in the morning and have to worry about getting sued by their coworkers if a work accident occurs when they're performing the essential functions of their job. Now,
Justice Bradley, I know that you have a question. Can I ask one additional question to follow up?
Right, I'll demur.
Thank you. Same fact situation that I gave you, one additional fact, as he's pulling it into the service bay. He's in the service bay and he's pulling it forward. He had some drinks for lunch, and he's .09.
And your question, Judge?
Is that operation?
It depends what statute we're talking about. That's another thing that Mr. McNeil has never addressed at any level of this litigation, and that's the purpose behind the statute. Now, conceivably, I don't make myself out to be a drunk driving criminal defense lawyer expert, but under the definition of the drunk driving statute, I suppose it's conceivable one could be found to be operating a motor vehicle under that statute and at the same token not be found to be operating a motor vehicle under 10203 sub 2, the narrow exception of the workers' comp rule. Now, that doesn't mean a claim perhaps for an intentional tort under the other limited exception couldn't be brought, but the fact of the matter is the public policy behind the drunk driving statute and the workers' comp statute, they are like night and day. There is no definition under 10203.02, but there is for the drunk driving statute, and there is for a good reason. There is a very broad definition, and there's a broad definition because we want to punish and deter drunk driving, and we want to permit law enforcement to have the ability to prevent and stop people from getting in a car and operating in a vehicle while intoxicated. You got a safety policy, and under the Work Comp Act, I never read this, and I wanted to read it. It's throughout the briefs, but some of the policy. Injuries caused by negligent co-employees are everyday occurrences. Such injuries are directly related to the employment, and pursuant to the stated purpose of the or objective of the Workers' Compensation Act, the cost should be passed on to the consuming public. Because of the strong policy concerns that underlie the rule of co-employee immunity, we construe exceptions to that statutory rule narrowly. When a statute is ambiguous, the legislature is presumed to have intended an interpretation that advances the purposes of the statute. And the purposes of this statute, Your Honors, is to provide co-employee immunity. One other brief, and there's a lot of history and scope in my briefs, I just wanted to touch on one other thing. And it talks about the impact that this case is going to have. It's on 22 of my brief. New liabilities on employers or employees should not be imposed by courts without compelling and well-understood reasons. While court remedy could be beneficent and just in a particular case, such precedent, unless carefully considered from the viewpoint of general state policy, could well gut the Workers' Compensation Act, create injustice, and substantially impair the exclusive remedy provision, which has made the Workers' Compensation Act tolerable to employers. Now, that's touch of the policy behind 10203 sub 2 versus the obvious public policy regarding drunk driving. So to answer your question, conceivably, yes, but again, as I've indicated earlier, I don't have to worry about that in the factual circumstances of my case here.
Does the Consumer Product Safety Commission concern itself with defects in automobiles? Or is there some other agency? What I'm really trying to get at is this is a manual transmission and a Jeep. Is this a rare occurrence, or do Jeeps do this all the time?
I don't know. I don't think it happens all the time, but it happens more times than we know. Accidents can happen at the workplace. And you bring up a point that I think about in analyzing this case. We all know that, as Justice Abrahamson said, workers' compensation is to be the exclusive remedy for work injuries. You're not supposed to sue co-employees. So the mason who drops a brick on his co-worker, the co-worker can't sue the guy that dropped the brick. The construction worker who drops the toolbox from scaffolding lands on the co-worker. There cannot be litigation between those two. And this gets a little closer, though. And you've seen it. We've all seen it. Machines. Employees are injured all the times on machines. And cut and injured and losing limbs and killed. And if somebody allegedly negligently operated a machine that caused something to injure his coworker, the coworker couldn't sue. But we're talking about a situation where, you know, Brendan Hansen's performing part of his job on his premises in the service bay to a car that's connected to a radiator flush machine standing outside of the car, and we're going to say, well, we should incorporate the drunk driving statute. That's wrong. That's not the intention of the legislature, and it's got to be narrowly construed. And in a narrow construction would not find that circumstance to be operation. And I don't think it was the intention of the legislature when carving out this limited exception to place a higher burden of liability on automotive repair workers. Otherwise, if you say, because starting engines, as one of the justices, I believe it was Wilcox, that's an integral part of servicing motor vehicles. Was it the intention of the legislature to make them more susceptible to legal liability? And on top of that, obviously it's a workers' comp act, right? Is it the intention of the legislature to not only leave them susceptible to legal liability, but also to make guys like Brendan Hansen reimburse the workers' comp carrier for benefits paid to the injured co-employee? I don't think so.
I still ask your indulgence. I need your help to figure out legally the difference between my hypothetical on the highway where turn the key, activate the ignition. If we had that case here, my sense is that we'd say, well, you know, that's physical manipulation, constituted activation of the controls necessary, you know, to put the car in motion, or whatever the definition is, something like that, the one that's most often used. And that highway situation, I'd say, there's a cause of action. Is the plaintiff, I don't know if the plaintiff's going to recover, but it sounds like the defendant might be negligent. But the important question is, does that constitute operating a motor vehicle under the statute? And I would be inclined to say yes, the very same activity of turning the key. Yet there's something about this fact situation that causes me to pause. And I need your help to give me the legal analysis, I can't quite figure out the distinction, because the action of what operates a motor vehicle is the same, and that's what we're defining. So what you can't just say the facts are different. I mean, of course they're different, but that, you know, that's not it.
Yeah, I've said that before today.
Yeah. What's the legal difference? What can you give us a hook to hang on to, where the same action on the highway could be operating a motor vehicle because you're manipulating the controls, you know, and it's being turned on. And in this environment, it isn't. I just can't figure that out.
Well,
now maybe you don't agree with me on the highway that it wouldn't be.
In your factual scenario, is the person inside of the car or outside of the car?
Front going to change the front tire. Out in front going to change the front tire.
No, but the person turns the key.
No, just like this one. You know, through the window, turns the key.
I would say, you know, another interesting, Mr. McNeil cites four various statutes which have completely different legislative purposes in context as opposed to the narrow exception to the Workers' Comp Act. And under the scenario that you're proposing, you know, it's interesting he didn't cite the motor vehicle statute definition of the term operator, which I believe is 34001 sub 41. Operator means a person who drives or is in actual physical control of a vehicle. And I guess under your circumstance, everything else being the same, I would argue that it's a narrow exception and therefore you must be narrowly construed. I would say that she is not in physical control of the vehicle. She certainly isn't driving the vehicle. So under that scenario, I would say no.
And 346.63 says, operate means the physical manipulation or activation of any of the controls of a motor vehicle necessary to put it in motion. Under that definition, it would be yes.
Right. Now, that is the drunk driving statute, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In that statute, you know, and that's another thing. Mr. McNeil skirts away from key things you got to face. And long and short of it is, when the day is all over, statute's ambiguous. Here we are, having great conversations about the statute. So the statute is ambiguous. You have to look at the legislative purpose. And like I'm kind of repeating myself, but the purpose behind the drunk driving statute is not consistent with the goals and the public policy that cannot be gutted of the Workers' Compensation Act. They're totally different, and that's a key canon of construction here. You've got to look at that, and Mr. McNeil has never looked at that. How can you go ahead and plug that statute that you just read as the definition of the limited exception that needs to be narrowly construed? I don't think you reasonably can.
Mr. Stewart, if I can, I know that a lot of the discussion has focused on the concept of operating a motor vehicle, and I think that's taken up the bulk of our time here. But I want to refer to 10203 sub 2. And the term that we're defining, as I understand it, is negligent operation of a motor vehicle. Not operating a motor vehicle, but negligent operation of a motor vehicle. Does an individual have to be operating, so to speak, a motor vehicle in order to come under the confines of the statute and negligent operation?
Understood.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a slight difference there. They're pretty similar. And I guess I referred to the fact that the failure to cite that statute is important, the motor vehicle code operator, because it doesn't fall in the operator. But you know what? This court here, the Supreme Court of Wisconsin, has already ruled in a case in Groff, which is cited in Attorney Friedman's brief, who was representing the Wisconsin Manufacturers Association, who, might I add, is part of the advisory council with respect to the legislatures of workers' comp, But this Supreme Court has already ruled in a different scenario that maintenance of a motor vehicle, including turning a key, does not constitute use and does not constitute operation. Now, granted, we were talking about a slightly different scenario here with respect to the applicability of the direct action statute, which, Your Honors, is also to be liberally construed. And you know what this Court said? This Court said maintenance of a motor vehicle is not operation of a motor vehicle. And that's in Groff, Gullickson, and I think those two cases derive from a case called Fry, and they're cited in Attorney Friedman's and Attorney Schmidt's brief regarding this. One last point I wanted to make is that counsel also says that, or Mr. McNeil indicates that the position of my client is in derogation of the common law because, you know, in the common law, co-employees could sue one another. Well, as I've articulated in the briefs and a bit here before you today, that we have a clear stated legislative purpose behind the exclusive remedy provision of the Workers' Comp Act. It's a clear purpose. And I guess if you took his argument to its logical end, he would claim that the entire exclusive remedy provision of the Workers' Comp Act is in derogation of the common law. The rule is immunity, and the exception to the rule is liability, and you got to view the exceptions narrowly. Under the circumstances of this case, under the circumstances presented by Justice Bradley, a person basically doing the same thing only on the road with their traveling salesman, under the circumstances presented by Justice Butler, I find all those circumstances to be not operation of a motor vehicle when you take the context and purpose of the statute into play here. In with respect to the Connecticut case that I referred to, it doesn't have to be a bright line rule that you adopt, but I think the hazards of employment and the hazards to the general public are something to consider here. And this was a work injury that occurred at the workplace, that occurred among coworkers, and it's a workers' compensation claim, not a personal injury claim. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Becker, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Just going to try to address a few things real quickly. The example is given by Justice Butler and Justice Bradley. I was going to use another example. I mean, if you look at, in this case, he turned the key, the car lurched forward. There may have been a hose hooked up to the engine. What if he got done with the oil change, closed the hood, and still started the car just to see how it ran? And it lurched forward and pinned him against the garage door. Take a third scenario. He intends to back the car out, turns the key, and it lurches forward. In all three cases, the conduct of the defendant is the same. The consequences of his conduct are the same.
Counselor, is the purpose of the key turn necessary for our decision? In other words, if the purpose for which someone turns on the key is part of the employee's job, is that a different key turn than turning on the key in Justice Bradley's example where it's not part of his job?
I don't see where it makes a difference. I mean, it's the operation of a motor vehicle. I mean,
well, that's what we're all trying to figure out. I mean,
well, right. I mean, again, the conduct is exactly the same regardless of what you're doing. It's hard to say, well, the conduct here does not constitute operate motor vehicle, but this exact same conduct over here does. I mean, that's what they're trying to say. They have given us no definition of operate. All they say is we have to apply it on a case-by-case basis. They cannot tell us a definition. It's been years in this court. They have not come up with one definition of operate that would be construed more narrowly than what we have in the legislature, in the statutes. In the 1970s, they adopted the drunk driving definition. They didn't go through the statutes and say, let's look at every place we have operate in the statutes and now redefine it wherever we have it. If you hit operate in the statutes, there's 2,500 hits that it's going to come up. In 1985, they created the ATV statute, defined operate the exact same way. In 1987, they amended the operator without owner's consent. They included a definition at that time, the exact same definition. In 1991, they amended the snowmobile statute. They amended it. They have this exact same definition. Do you really think that meant something different in this statute? That's just not common sense. If they really meant something different than something they've included every single time they addressed the issue, they would put it in there, I would think. That's my opinion. So if you look at the development of the statute and what the legislature has intended, that is a narrow definition. Again, it could be interpreted much more broadly. Turning on the windshield wipers.
Mr. Becker,
I'm sorry.
I could.
I'm just trying to rush. I hope I
I understand. I'm looking at, and I refer you to the case of Graff versus, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Bleckel, which was cited in the amicus brief, 36 was second,
right.
Page 635. That case interprets statutes dealing with, in my read of this, insurance coverage. It talks in terms of operation of a motor vehicle. And in looking at the decision, and I'll just read from the decision, quote, maintenance of an automobile has never been considered a part of operation or of management and control. Maintenance connotes a state of physical repair. Management and control refer to the manner of its use. And even in the dictionary senses, these words do not readily admit of the inclusion of maintenance. The attempt to start the motor in the case at bar was a part of a process of repair and consequently an act of maintenance, not use, operation, management, or control of the vehicle. Now, admittedly, the statute that was being interpreted in Graff doesn't involve any of the statutes we've talked about here today, but it does talk about operation, negligent operation, in the context of insurance right. coverage. So what's your reaction to the Graff decision?
Okay, several things. First of all, in the Hasselstrom versus Rex chain belt, it's 50. I'm sorry. The state got cut off. It's 50 was second. Page 497.
497.
At page 497, it says Chapter 14, Laws of 1967, which became effective on April 1st, nullified the effect of the decisions in Frye and Graff. But again, it's relating to a different statute. But even looking at the language in Graff, several things come out in Graff. First of all, the vehicle was inoperable. It was incapable of being moved. Secondly, since that time, we've had the development of the definition in the legislature over the period of four different times when they've included a definition of operate. And third, I think the court's wrong to suggest that it has to be mutually exclusive. You can operate a vehicle in the course of maintaining it. You pick up the mechanic and you say, okay, let's go for a drive and listen for what the noise is. Or you're driving through a car wash. Washing your car is maintaining your vehicle, but you're still operating the vehicle. So they don't have to be mutually exclusive, which is the inference from the Graff case, and I think that's wrong.
Chief, if I might be permitted, I've got one last question. And this is if you know and you may not know, and if you don't, that's fine. But do you have any idea in dealing with these type of maintenance or service type facilities, how many of the mechanics that work at these facilities may have either suspended or revoked or be licenses or be unlicensed persons that nevertheless are qualified to work on vehicles?
I don't know. And I couldn't tell you. I guess if I'm an employer and I have somebody who's working for me without a license, I don't want them driving a customer's car. But I couldn't tell you that. I don't know.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you,
Mr. Becker, and thank you, Mr. Stewart, for your argument on operation of a motor vehicle in a different context than we've seen the word recently. That ends our hearing in 05AP423, Carl McNeil versus Brandon Hansen, and that concludes our scheduled sittings for oral arguments in October. The court will meet in the conference room at 3:05 and close.